welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 15th of March 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Once again, it's the start of another week and I am here today with my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring to discuss the weekend's news and everything that is of interest to our fellow British nationalists. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm very well indeed, thank you.
Excellent.
It's been a lovely weekend, actually, nice and sunny most of the weekend, and that can't be bad, can it? And we're drawing ever nearer to the end of lockdown, hopefully.
Yes, something to look forward to. It's been a bit miserable here, miserable old weather here, so I don't mind being indoors today to record our podcast together. We've got a few little bits and pieces of news to get into, and you were just telling me before we went on air, Max, about something to do with Bashar al-Assad's wife.
Yes, it's been announced recently that an organization calling itself Guernica 37, and those people who have got a good knowledge of history from the early part of the 20th century will know that Guernica was a town in Spain that was became very famous during the Spanish Civil War, where I believe it was the German Air Force intervened on the side of Franco and bombed Guernica. And so it's a kind of a rallying cry for people on the left who are of a kind of anti-fascist disposition. Guernica 37 is a legal chambers. They style themselves as International Justice Chambers, and they're based in London. And apparently they've made a referral to the Metropolitan Police, and more specifically to the Counter-Terrorism Command of the Metropolitan Police, which is SO15. And the Metropolitan Police have confirmed that they've opened an investigation into Asma al-Assad for war crimes, and more specifically that she has been involved in inciting and encouraging acts of terrorism. I just can't help feeling that this is another instance of Britain sticking our nose into somebody else's business, where we don't really know what's been going on, because let's face it, Syria has been in a state of chaos for most of the 10 years, apart from the parts of Syria that have been under the control of Bashar al-Assad's armies. And so therefore, we don't really know what's going on. One of the things I find is very, very sad is that it would appear that Asma al-Assad is really just being picked upon by virtue of the fact that she is Bashar al-Assad's wife. There's apparently supposed to be some sort of allegation that she used her influence, because she was an investment banker formerly in her existence prior to marrying Bashar al-Assad. She was an investment banker in London, and apparently she is accused of having used her influence or influence gained during her career as a banker in order to try and help her husband to rally the country behind him and to wage war on those forces who were attacking Syria, i.e. Primarily Al-Qaeda. It's just a fairly sort of distasteful episode that I think is opening up, where we're going to, as I say, stick our nose into somebody else's business and end up making the situation worse.
They're just picking on her because she's his wife. By all accounts, she's a very nice lady. She does a lot of charity work. She's a British citizen. That's why they're going after her. When she married Bashar al-Assad, he was an optician. He was an eye doctor. He never thought he was going to be the president of Syria. He just became the president of Syria by default. And she was his wife. I think that's it's terrible that they're going after this lady just because she's his wife. She's not a part of the government. She's just married to him. And as I say, there's plenty of pictures of her helping out orphans and charities, and it doesn't seem like they've got anything on her, really, apart from the fact that she's married to him. And this group that are responsible for this, they sound like left-wing Antifa activists. Once again, we see the government being used, the strong arm of the law, being used by these left-wing groups, not just to go after people in Britain, but now to go after people in other countries as well. I think it's very sad that our law enforcement has become so politicized and it gets used by groups like Hope Not Hate, this group here. And it's even sadder that they're going abroad.
Guernica 37, just to put the record straight here, Guernica 37 are not an Antifa kind of organization. They're not violent or anything of that sort, but they are, by the suggestion of the name, probably going to be a left-wing and an anti-fascist oriented legal firm. But they are a firm of barristers, so I don't think we could equate them with Antifa. But they're certainly they certainly will have their own agenda, I think, here as far as this prosecution is concerned.
Well, we did actually have some policing that wasn't politicised over the weekend as well. This murder of Sarah Everard, this hideous murder of this woman that was just walking home, and it looks like it was a police officer that kidnapped. He's been accused of kidnapping her and murdering her, and also accused of exposing himself the next day in a McDonald's. It's all very strange. And then he mysteriously had a head injury, which he incurred within his prison cell. Over the weekend, there was a vigil that was held for this woman. Hundreds of people came out for this vigil. And of course, at the moment, we have legislation in place which says that nobody can protest with more than two people. And we've seen the elderly being manhandled by the police, women in their 70s that have been arrested and processed in a police station for daring to protest against the lockdown. And of course, we said, well, this was politicized policing. And then last year we saw Black Lives Matter and they were out protesting, and thousands of them were allowed to go out and pull down statues and graffiti statues and throw push bikes at mounted police on horseback. And we were told these were peaceful protests and the police did nothing about it. And I was expecting the police to do nothing about this vigil, but they did. Apparently four arrests were made. The crowd at this vigil were shouting, "No justice, no peace, F the police." So it was obviously taken over by part of the Black Lives Matter contingent. And the police are being accused of being very heavy-handed here. They're calling for Cressida Dick to resign. Sadiq Khan, the acting mayor of London, he said the scenes were unacceptable and that he was urgently seeking an explanation from Police Commissioner Cressida Dick. And of course, he did the same with Black Lives Matter. He was supporting the Black Lives Matter riots, and then he was condemning entirely the patriots that went to protest the fact that the statues were being pulled down. So we see political policing most of the time, but this incident over the weekend, this was not political policing, and the police did try to break up this protest, which is exactly what they're supposed to be doing. That's what they've been told to do. So I'm not really on the side of the feminists that were having this protest. They're basically getting the same treatment that everybody else has got. And of course, the left are screaming about this now and are saying that Cressida Dick needs to resign for this. A lot of hypocrisy that's going on here. Max, did you see these scenes? It's headline news at the moment.
Yeah, I have seen some of the information about it. And it's typical, really, that we've had the wokearty all complaining over the course of the last year whenever anybody appears to have done something which is in defiance of lockdown, or whenever anybody has belittled the threat posed to us by COVID-19. And have been claiming that anybody that's done that has been is responsible for deaths and there's blood on their hands because they've encouraged other people to defy the lockdown and that's caused other people to die. And yet here we have the wokearty out in force in order to protest a cause which is important to their own hearts and falling foul of their own calls for policing to be by the letter of the law when the police do confront demonstrations of this type. I'm not suggesting that the death of Sarah Everard isn't a worthy cause, because I think it is a worthy cause. I think it's disgusting that people are unable to walk the streets of Britain without fear. But where I part, where I take part from the feminists that have been campaigning for all this is that, firstly, I agree with you that I think that the policing was non-political policing on this occasion, and it's difficult for me to make statements in defence of Cressida Dick, but I think when it's appropriate, then we should do that sort of thing. But the inference of the feminists is that this is a matter, that apparently we claim that this is a matter for women, that women should be careful and they should not go out at times when it's dangerous, and they shouldn't walk through dangerous areas because that's not the way it should be. And the feminists claim that that it's necessary for men to change the way that we think about women and the way that we and the way that we behave. And what these feminists completely ignore is that it's not just women who sometimes fear going out. You know, I wouldn't go walking across Clapham Common late at night on my own. I might do, but I wouldn't feel safe doing it. And if I wouldn't feel safe doing it, then obviously any woman in their right mind wouldn't feel safe doing it either. And if I would avoid doing something that makes me feel unsafe, then I think it's only reasonable and to expect a woman to avoid doing something that she feels is dangerous. And the point is that the people who attack other people in the streets, they don't attack other people simply because they're women. What they do is they attack people that are weaker than themselves. So whether it's a sex attacker, or whether it is a mugger who's mugging you for money, or whether it's somebody who is trying to drive you out of an area that they are ethnically cleansing or something of that sort, the attacker will attack somebody or people that appear to be weaker than them. And it's not just women that feel vulnerable in that kind of a situation. What you have are elderly men feel vulnerable in that situation. Disabled men feel vulnerable in that kind of a situation. Small men feel vulnerable in that kind of a situation. But even men who are young and fit and strong and who may have had martial arts training or anything of that sort, even men of that kind, if they've got any sense, will feel worried for their safety when they're out walking late at night in certain parts of Britain. Not just because they might be attacked by somebody who's bigger than themselves, but they might be attacked by a group of people. And against a group of people, they may not stand a chance. And there are lots of instances of groups of people attacking lone walkers at night. And it could be that they might be attacked by somebody who's carrying a weapon, like a machete or a butcher's cleaver or something of that sort. And so this isn't an issue of men neglecting to do what we should do in order to protect women. This is an issue of our society as a whole not doing everything we could do to protect our citizens against this kind of attack.
I think another point to make is that it was a white police officer that did this. So that's why they're all out protesting. When it was young white girls that were being groomed and raped by Muslim gangs, we never saw huge, great protests like this. That there's been white girls that have been allegedly chopped up and put into kebab meat, and we never saw protests like this. There's a racial side to this as well. I just want to bring up some figures here as well. In the last 20 years, the number of rapes in this country have gone from 18,000 to 64,000. So there are four times as many rapes happening in the country now in the last 20 years. Is that linked to the massive increase in immigration? Is that linked to the massively high rape rate that we see in countries like Africa, non-white countries? We've had a massive boom in the numbers of non-whites, and we've had a massive increase in the number of crimes, and that's why people are frightened to go out. And this is not the white way of doing things. The white man doesn't see weakness and thinks there's a prey, somebody I can prey upon. The white man sees weakness and thinks that's something that should be protected. Innocence should be protected. The big man should look out for the smaller man. The gentleman should look out for the woman. That's the white way of doing things. It's completely alien to us to see weakness and think that that is something that we should prey upon. But unfortunately, that is the way that some of these people think, or at least a proportion of them think, of these groups that we have invited into our country. You know, it's such a shame that this we only see these protests when it's a white man that is guilty of this. I just wanted to make that point that there is a racial factor to this, Max. I don't know if you want to continue with what you were saying or add to what I was saying.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think you're absolutely right there. And, you know, you spoke about gentlemanliness. And what we find is that for decades now, feminists have been sneering at gentlemanliness, and they've been sneering at the thought that that men might be more polite to women because that is the correct way to behave. And what we need in order to correct the situation is, first of all, is more beat policemen. We need to have more policemen out on the beat so that it increases the possibility of them spotting roving gangs of people that are out looking for prey. It also means that the police won't be far away if anybody does get attacked. They can get there, that they'll always be close at hand. What we need are tougher sentences for criminals. And so what we want is for feminists and people on the left and the wokerati to stop campaigning when there are tough sentences in the offing for people who have committed crimes. We want to have and to stop protesting when people who have been released from prison, having committed terrible crimes, are then going to be deported back to their own country. We want them to stop protesting in those kind of situations, because otherwise you just have more sex offenders and more violent people in our country. What we need are tougher immigration controls, and we need to exclude people who come from lawless countries, or at least be incredibly selective about anybody coming into Britain who comes from a lawless country, because lawless countries don't exist just by chance. It's not just a matter of chance that lots of places in the third world are virtually lawless. It happens because the people that live in those lawless countries don't have respect for law and order, and haven't had respect for law and order for generations in the way that people in Britain have had respect for law and order. And so we need to be very circumspect about allowing large numbers of people to immigrate into Britain from countries that have got very poor law and order records. And we need to exclude anybody that's got a criminal record. So instead of being all soft-hearted and thinking, oh, well, should we let this rapist come into our country, even though he, you know, just because he happens to come from a country where there is a civil war? Well, no, I think that we should send that rapist back to the country that they came from. And we need to deport criminals. So at the end of their prison sentences, once they are sentenced and here in Britain, then they ought to be deported back to their country of origin, so we don't have a disproportionately large number of criminals in our society. That's the way to get law and order established. That's the way to create freedom for people, whether they happen to be women, whether they happen to be men, whether they happen to be children or whatever, freedom for them to be able to enjoy our streets, our open spaces, and our countryside unmolested. And you know, I'm old enough to remember a time when children could go out and play, and children could travel across the residential estate in which they lived, and could then go into the woods and explore the woods either on their own or in small groups and be perfectly safe. I can remember a time when that was possible. I can remember a time when the idea that somebody would be raped or mugged in my hometown was so remote as to be almost beyond consideration. But now, in the town in which I was born, there are very high levels of crime, and it isn't safe for people to walk around in certain areas late at night. And this is the sort of thing that the left and the feminists and the wokerati, they need to wake up to the fact that it's the social policies that they are pursuing that are actually turning our society into the kind of society where they aren't safe.
That's the point, isn't it? They are missing the cause of all of this. And this is really highlighted by something that was said last week in the House of Lords. We had Green Party MP Baroness Jones, and she gave a speech in the House of Lords. And in the speech, she said what she would like to do is, at the right moment and in the right bill, she wanted to introduce a 6 p.m. curfew for men, all men, to have to be home by 6 p.m. at night. And the reasons that were given for this is, 91% of crimes are carried out by men, so we need to put all the men indoors by 6 p.m. Well, what about the fact that blacks are responsible for five times as much crime as whites? And we suggest that we should have policing that is based on that. And yet we would get accused of being racist for saying that. And she wasn't accused of being mannist for saying this. And this idea of all men should take the blame for the few that actually do carry out these crimes, I mean, it's abominable. I mean, just there's no logic there in actually what she is saying. If she was to get rid of all the men, who's going to be there to protect the women when they go out? You would just end up with gangs, immigrant gangs of females that were attacking the females, because we do see a massively high crime rate actually amongst black females, which is far higher than you actually get amongst white females. And we even had Drakeford in Wales, the Premier of Wales. He said, well, this sounds like a good idea. If it needed it, I would vote for this. I mean, it's absolutely ludicrous, this idea. It's just about hating men. They refuse to actually draw any distinctions between the ones that are likely to be carrying out these crimes and the ones that aren't. All we have to do is look at the crime statistics before we had mass immigration. Just look at the crime statistics in the 40s, the 30s, the 20s, and you will see that Britain used to be completely safe. You used to be able to leave your front door unlocked. The children could play outside till dark. Nobody would be abducted. You wouldn't hear of murders. You wouldn't hear of muggings. You wouldn't hear of acid attacks. And yet all men are now being blamed for this, as if all men suddenly changed over the last 40 years and became these crime-prone monsters. And it's just not true, and it's not fair to blame all men for this. We get told that we blame all women for things, and we don't. I mean, this is just rank hypocrisy here, and it just shows you the lunacy of some of these crazy Greens. And it's very unfortunate, because as a nationalist, we care very much about the environment. I'm sure you do as much as me, Max. And yet our representatives that want to talk about the environment, they're lunatics like this. They're feminists, and they call for more immigration. They don't actually stand up for green policies. What do you make of this crazy Baroness Jones woman?
Well, I don't really want to comment further on her, apart from the fact that the suggestion of a curfew for men is ludicrous and bordering on misandry. You see, these feminists call for misogyny to be made a hate crime, but then they completely ignore misandry, which is the hatred of men, and don't think that it would be appropriate for a hatred of men to become a hate crime. When, you know, if it's hateful to hate women, then it's hateful to hate men. And so I think that perhaps they ought to think again about that, and as to whether or not they want to have misandry included with misogyny as a hate crime. But also, I think that it's high time that ageism was made a hate crime as well. You know, if we're going to have a society driven by hate crimes, and if our behaviour is to be coerced and sculpted and formed by our adherence to the law relating to hate crimes, well, let's have a hate crime for ageism as well, because as time goes on, what I see are more and more people sneering at old people, because it's older people who remember how it used to be prior to mass immigration into this country. And when we talk about the times that existed prior to mass immigration, we get laughed at and we get derided as if we're already one foot in the grave and already semi-senile, when in fact that isn't the case. It's just that older people can actually remember a better time when it was safer in this country. And we shouldn't be derided and we shouldn't be mocked just because we can and just because we're older. And so perhaps we ought to have ageism as a hate crime as well. And
well,
the number,
that,
what we then see is the feminists saying, oh, no, no, we don't want to have too many hate crimes, because if we have too many hate crimes, what we say, what the feminists say, will become illegal. And it would be good to see the shoe on the other foot and them getting a taste of their own medicine.
Well, I was just thinking there, you know, if they did make ageism a hate crime, at least then we might get some protection for our elderly white folks. And they have put that forward, actually, that making age a protected characteristic, along with immigration status and asylum status in the law review in England. I don't like to see them expand it. If they are going to expand it, obviously it would be better to have elderly whites in there, but we shouldn't have these protected groups that we are not allowed to hold up to scrutiny in society. And it's interesting you brought up the subject of misogyny there, because in Scotland they actually brought in their infamous Scottish hate crime law last week. They had a debate on this on Thursday, a 5-hour debate, and instead of pointing out what a threat to free speech this is and what a tyrannical law it is, the debate was all about whether they should include misogyny in it, and they decided that what they were going to do is have a completely separate law that they were going to make about misogyny and making that illegal. And what they include in misogyny is people complimenting women, males complimenting women. One woman's compliment, like a cat call or something like that, that makes her feel good, is another woman's hate crime. So again, it's something entirely subjective. But this law that they brought in Scotland, I didn't think it was going to pass, because it had united all these different groups in society. You had the secular society were against it, you had the church that were against it, you had the police that were against it, you had comedians against it, poets against it. I mean, they were saying that it's going to actually make the Bible illegal. Quoting parts of the Bible would be illegal. It's been put forward by this infamous Scottish MP, Humza Yousaf, who made this speech where he was literally spitting out the word white with such hatred apparent in his face and in his voice. Just incredible that nobody reported him for a hate crime for his speech, where he just listed off all these posts that were actually filled by white people in Scotland. Of course, it's going to be filled by white people. Scotland is a white country. It was built by white Scottish people. So it's going to have white Scottish people in most of the heads of departments, isn't it? But he seemed to think that that was a horrible thing, and all these whites needed replacing. So they brought this in last week, and their excuse at the end of it, they said, I'll read this quote to you. Yousaf accepted one amendment from the Scottish Conservative MSP Adam Tompkins, who is also a convener of Holyrood's Justice Committee, which restated the rights under the ECHR Article 10 and emphasised the right to offend, shock or disturb in relation to a reasonableness defence. So what they did, they basically put something in there that's already a part of law anyway, and they added it to the bill. So it's made no difference whatsoever. They just added a part from the Human Rights Act, which they don't seem to uphold anyway, the right to offend, shock or disturb, and said, OK, that does it. That gives us protection here. And apparently this law, it they can also use this law within your own home. So it's always been an Englishman's home is his castle. OK, this is in Scotland. But that effectively means that you would be gagged within your own home. Your children could go to the teacher and say, well, I don't like what my dad said. He said something that wasn't too positive about blacks. And the father could be arrested for that, for something that he said within his own home. I mean, surely the head of the family is sovereign within his own home, but not anymore. I've got another quote here, but I'll pass it over to you, Max, for your thoughts on the Scottish hate crime bill.
Well, just that it appears that justice, as with many other things, we're becoming more and more a society, well, a police state kind of society, a society where there is no freedom of speech, and where a kind of Stasi exists. And it was estimated during the height of the Cold War that the Stasi had something like one in five people in Eastern Europe who were informants for them, and we are sort of progressively moving towards a situation where there will be a substantial number of people from the left, a substantial number of people who are multicultural campaigners, who will be have their ear to the wall with listening through a glass through the partition wall between two semi-detached houses to the conversation taking place in the next door's house, and who will be hot on the phone to the police if anybody says something which is not very woke. And people on the nationalist scene have been predicting for years now that we're developing into a kind of Eastern European society. It seems as though countries on the other side of the Iron Curtain have become more liberal, and what's happened is that countries on our side of the Iron Curtain are becoming more and more authoritarian and coercive in terms of the legislation that we live under. And it's just a very sad thing, because that's not what our forefathers fought for. Our forefathers fought for us to remain free, for us to be able to speak our mind, for a sticks and stones will hurt my bones, but names will never hurt me kind of society. But that's not what we've got now. And hopefully we can arrest the development of this sort of thing and turn the clock back to a happier time.
Well, we need to be able to talk about these things, but it's not even going to be people listening in and trying to listen in to what the conversation is, because everybody's got these gadgets in their houses now, haven't they, that are hooked up to the internet, and they speak to the gadget and they think it's wonderful, and the gadget looks up whatever it is they just said on the internet. So it's there recording everything that everybody says. And now in Scotland, they've got a law which says that if you say anything within the four walls of your home, it's as if you just said that outside on a public street corner, and you're inciting people. So they don't even have to have somebody telling tales on the father or whatever, because everybody's got these gadgets that are recording everything that they say anyway. So all they would have to do is listen in on that gadget to anybody that they had a suspicion of might be a thought criminal. And that would be it. And I don't believe that was brought up in the conversation about this when they were discussing it. I have another quote here from this is from this Tompkins, the Conservative MSP. He says, "So much fear has been stoked in relation to these matters that it is important to set that out." And that's to do with the ECHR Article 10. "Criticising policy relating to transgender identity is not a hate crime under the bill, even if you express yourself in a manner that others find transphobic. It is not a hate crime to discuss or to criticise matters relating to transgender identity." And of course you hear that and on the surface you think, oh, well, that's good, maybe we've got some protections. But think about it. He's just talking about you can criticise matters relating to transgender identity. Does that mean you can criticise matters relating to transgender behaviour, criticise crimes carried out by transgenders, bring up statistics to do with transgenders? Because they can say, well, that's nothing to do with the identity, is it? If you were to transpose that to blacks, say, and black criminal statistics, they would just say, well, that's got nothing to do with black identity. So we can still say that is a hate crime. He also added that a clear explanation to the police and the public was now essential. And this is a big problem with these laws. They've never been properly explained to the public. The public are still not aware of exactly what it means about this intent to incite hate and how that can be proved, because people are still thinking, well, this leaflet is entirely legal, so if I post this leaflet, I can't be doing anything illegal. But if the person that is posting that leaflet has social media accounts where they have expressed racial slurs, then they are doing something illegal by delivering that leaflet. And that needs to be explained to the general public. And then finally here, Tompkins and fellow Conservative Liam Kerr failed to secure an amendment that they argued would protect disagreements, for example, at the family dinner table. So they can now arrest you for things that you say within your own home. They have introduced this new stirring up offence, and they don't have to actually show that you had any intent to incite hatred. They just have to say, well, we think it could have been stirred up with this You could have the best of intentions. You could have used the absolute best wording. And then just because a minority advocacy group says, well, we don't like it, then they can say, well, you were trying to stir up hate, even if you had no intent of doing it. So it's a crime that people can be prosecuted for when there is no intent to actually commit any crime at all. And it's just talking about things that the state don't want you to talk about. It's an absolute tragedy for free speech. It's absolutely shameful what we are doing with our laws at the moment, I think. Have you got any final thoughts on this, Max? Anything else you'd like to say on that?
Well, just that these kind of laws are very woolly in terms of the wording, and there are immense grey areas, and they're designed specifically to be very woolly and with those grey areas. And what that provides is the scope for the authorities to be impartial in the way in which they apply the law, so that they can turn a blind eye when they want to interpret a piece of legislation as if it doesn't cover a particular area. But then if somebody that they don't like says the same kind of thing that somebody that they've just excused says, then they can decide to apply the law. And so it becomes a matter not of what you say, but who you said it, who you've annoyed when you said it. It also becomes a matter of not what you do that creates a crime, and not just what you say that creates a crime, but what you think, not at the time when you supposedly committed the crime, but what you think at a time that's perhaps several years ago. And so if we're working on the basis that it's the motivation of somebody that determines whether they're guilty or not of a crime, then everything that you've ever thought or ever said, anything you've ever written down, no matter where you wrote it down, even if you wrote it in your secret diary that you kept locked and you never let anybody read, even if you wrote it in that, if the police get hold of that secret diary and they open it up and they decide that you had hateful thoughts several years ago, then all these things can be used to convict you of a thought crime today. And this is the dangerous situation that we're increasingly putting ourselves in, and people need to wake up.
They do. They need to realise what's going on with the law. And just one final thought on that. I mean, how can they prove beyond a shadow of a doubt what somebody was thinking? And this is why they've changed it to say, well, you don't need to prove intent anymore. Because obviously, you know, you can't say 100% we know what somebody was thinking when they did this. So now they're saying, well, we don't need to actually prove what you're thinking. We'll just say that we don't like it. And as you pointed out there, Max, it's not actually what the person has said or done. It's the person itself. Because, of course, if you're not one of these privileged groups and you're saying or thinking these things, then the law can be applied to you and you can be found guilty. If you're a member of one of these groups, of course, then you've got to get out of jail free card, haven't you? Well, shall we get into our greatest Britons then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's get into our greatest Briton for today, Enoch Powell. Once again, we'll start with a summary. Last week, we talked about Enoch Powell's questioning of the wisdom in Britain wasting resources on nuclear weapons when the arms race was between America and the USSR. Greenham Common was mentioned, and how the genders appeared to be split on the subject, with mainly women being against nuclear weapons. Immigration came up again, and the speed at which whites were being replaced in Britain's cities, with Powell alleging that there was a conspiracy of silence on the subject from the main parties. He also warned of the violence he feared was to come as race riots became a regular occurrence in places where 25 to 50% of all those under 25 were now of immigrant heritage. And finally, he gave a fantastic speech in Parliament where he demolished the idea that it was lack of employment and poverty that was causing the riots, pointing out that the people in question felt alienated because they were alien, and not because they were disadvantaged in any way by the host nation. Is there anything else you want to add to that, Max? Anything else that you want to flesh out?
No, that seems like a pretty good summary of where we've got to so far.
Okay, well, moving on from there, we'll take a break from Enoch Powell's thoughts on immigration, and we'll have a look at what was happening with the Falklands War. Powell wrote an article for The Times on the 29th of June 1982, in which he said, "The Falklands have brought to the surface of the British mind our latent perception of ourselves as a sea animal. No assault on a landward possession would have evoked the same automatic defiance, tinged with a touch of that self-sufficiency which belongs to all nations." So I think we can see here that he is seeing this Falklands War as being something positive, and it's caused us to remember British sea power and the fact that we used to rule the waves. And he also liked or thought this was a good thing because it also woke us up to the fact that America may not be our greatest ally. "The United States response was," he said, "very different, but just as deep an instinctual reaction. The United States have an almost neurotic sense of vulnerability. Its two coastlines, its two theatres, its two navies are separated by the entire length of the New World. She lives with the nightmare of having one day to fight a decisive sea battle without the benefit of concentration, the perpetual spectre of naval war on two fronts." Powell added, "The Panama Canal from 1914 onwards could never quite exercise that spectre. And it was the position of the Falkland Islands in relation to that route which gave and gives them their significance for the United States above all. The British people have become uneasily aware that their American allies would prefer the Falkland Islands to pass out of Britain's possession into hands which, if not wholly American, might be amenable to American control. In fact, the American struggle to wrest the islands from Britain has only commenced in earnest now that the fighting is over." And Powell then said that there was the Hispanic factor. "If we could gather together all the anxieties for the future, which in Britain cluster around race relations, and then attribute them, translated into Hispanic terms, to the Americans, we would have something of the phobias which haunt the United States and addressed itself to the aftermath of the Falklands campaign." So there's a lot there that he was thinking about that really would not have occurred to me, how America felt about this, and waking up the marine spirit in the British once again. And I don't really remember much from the Falklands, apart from everybody felt very patriotic, and it was miles away over the other side of the world. You probably remember the Falklands campaign a lot better than I do, Max. What are your thoughts on all of this?
It's interesting, the Powell's identifying of the American interests, and the fact that the Americans will have felt that they could influence Argentina far more than they could influence us, and that it was in their interest to have bases on the near Cape Horn, where they could protect their fleet if it had to pass from one side of the United States, from the Pacific side to the Atlantic side, and vice versa. And that's an aspect of the war which didn't have prominence during the time of the war, actually, and it is something which I think has been downplayed, because there was a realization partway through the Falklands War that the Americans weren't being as wholly pro-British as their special relationship, you know, ought to suggest, and that that there were questions being asked as to why we weren't getting the support from the Americans that we thought we ought to have. In fact, we weren't getting the support from the from Europe that we thought we ought to have, because the French carried on selling Exocet missiles to the Argentinians throughout the conflict, and it was those Exocet missiles that caused devastation for a number of our naval ships and caused a lot of deaths and disfigurements of soldiers who were caught in the flames below decks, etc. And so the Falklands War actually was a warning to us, first of all, that we couldn't always rely upon the the honest support of the United States of America, and that our special relationship that we thought we had at the end of the Second World War didn't really exist to the extent that we had previously thought it did, and also that the support that we thought we would get from our allies on the continent of Europe, those countries that were members of the European Union, our support from them wasn't as readily forthcoming as we thought it ought to be either. And so it was kind of like a realization on the part of the British public that we did need to still think about standing alone, and we did need to start thinking about how we would fare if we were in a world where we had no allies, or no allies of any importance. And I think that had we had any other prime minister at that time other than Margaret Thatcher, then that prime minister would almost certainly have just allowed the Falkland Islands to go, and for the Americans to, for the Argentinians to take the Falkland Islands, and they wouldn't have had the stomach for the fight. But Margaret Thatcher isn't somebody who is without her faults, or wasn't somebody who was without faults. But the one thing that she did have is that she did have courage, and she did have a determination that has been lacking, and a sense of national pride, and I suppose a sense of national vigour that has been almost entirely lacking in post-World War II leaders in this country. And she then, made a, I can't remember what the date was that she made the speech, but she made a speech in, it probably would have been in early April, where she made it absolutely clear that we were going to retake the Falkland Islands, and that the Falkland Islanders were British, and that we wouldn't desert them. And it was as a result of her determination that the naval task force was dispatched, and that the islands were recaptured.
I've just got a couple of thoughts there. I'm just wondering how it started. I mean, did the Argentinians invade? Did they fire shots on the British, or did they declare war on the British? And I'm also wondering what the nationalist perspective on this was, because I mean, Argentina, I think they're mainly white, aren't they, or majority white? And what was the nationalist view at white people going to war against other whites again? So two things there, Max. So how did it start, and what was the nationalist attitude at the time?
Well, it started with a number of statements being made by Argentinian spokespeople in the United Nations and similar organisations, where they laid claim to what they called the Malvinas, which is the Falkland Islands, and they claimed that because of the proximity of those islands to Argentina, that they were rightfully Argentinian, and it was only the British Empire and our imperialism that took those islands away from them, which isn't really true, because what happened during the sort of 1700s and the 1800s is that those islands were used by a range of ships from various different nations, who use them as refueling points and restocking points where they were going off hunting whales and things of that sort, or going down to the Antarctic to explore. And that was primarily the way in which they were used. But what happened was that at some point during the course of the history of the Falkland Islands, we set up a permanent settlement on those islands, or several permanent settlements. And those permanent settlements were overwhelmingly peopled by British people. And it became accepted that the Falkland Islands were British islands peopled by overwhelmingly British people, and that was that. But the Argentinians continued to hanker after the Falkland Islands, primarily because the Falkland Islands, if you look at the territorial waters around the Falkland Islands, it gives the Falkland Islanders access to quite substantial fishing grounds, and it also encompasses parts of the seabed where that are ripe for mineral extraction, for drilling for oil and things of that sort. And I think that the Argentinian government have got their eyes on this. But what then happened was that because the Argentinian diplomats have made these speeches in the United Nations, etc., and because nobody really countered them, and the fact that the British government and certainly the Foreign Office had kind of just dismissed these as just being the natterings of a country that had no real intention of retaking the Falkland Islands, there was no formal British response to these claims that had been made, and the Argentinian government interpreted that as us conceding that they were right, and that they had the right to take the Falkland Islands. And so one morning, a contingent of Argentinian soldiers landed on the islands, and I don't think it was a particularly large contingent, several thousand men, I think it was. They then proceeded to capture Stanley, which is the capital of the Falkland Islands, and the other major ports, and very little resistance was put up, because we had at the time a very small garrison of about 20 men who were stationed there, and they were then faced with an Argentinian force that was many times greater than they were, and so the garrison that was on the islands effectively surrendered without putting up very much of a very much resistance. And I think that was on the 2nd of April in 1982. And it was 3 days later that Margaret Thatcher dispatched the Naval Task Force in order to sail down to the South Atlantic and retake the islands. As far as the war against the Argentinians is concerned, Argentina is a country that's got to some extent, a mixed population, in that there are some communities within Argentina who are entirely English or British. There are some communities within Argentina who were German settlements or settlers, and settlers from other parts of Europe. And there is a very large community within Argentina who are Spanish and of Spanish descent, as well as a number of people who are descended from the original South American Indian tribes that inhabited Argentina before any Europeans got there. But the Falklands War wasn't waged in any way with any kind of racial consciousness. And as far as nationalists were concerned, we were outraged that islands that were almost entirely British in terms of their population had been snatched, and that they'd been snatched in order to for Argentina to snatch the mineral rights and the fishing rights. And also because of the strategic position of them, and that was the basis of our desire that the British government should retake the islands and reassert our ownership of those islands.
So there was a rebirth of patriotism then? There was a real feeling of patriotism, and the whole country was, this is not on. Did the whole country get behind Maggie Thatcher in her bid to take the islands back?
I would say that the vast majority did. I mean, there still were members of the opposition who were saying, "Oh, this is all going to end in disaster. How can we send a task force?" Because I think it was, I can't remember exactly what the distance is, but it's like about 7,000 miles. How can we send a task force 7,000 miles away? It's going to be militarily impossible for us to retake the islands. There are lots and lots of doubting Thomases who continue to voice those same opinions right up to the point where we actually physically invaded the islands. And one of the logistic problems that we had was that there was no base for the Air Force. And so what we had to do was to get Vulcan bombers, who were, even at that point in time, who were fairly sort of elderly. And these Vulcan bombers were then sent off to fly to the Falkland Islands, but en route they had to be refueled. I think it was at least twice on that journey, and it may possibly have been three times. And what happened was that there was this great logistical exercise that was done where the islands that we own that are in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, Tristan da Cunha and those kind of islands, the airports on those were had supply aircraft fly over and land and wait ready so that they could take off and then meet the Vulcan bombers as they flew down the along the Atlantic and to refuel them in the air. And as I say, this happened two or three times each journey, and the Vulcan bombers eventually reached the Falkland Islands and dropped their loads on the targets that were there for them to damage. And one of the things they did initially was to drop their bombs on the airfields on the Falkland Islands so that the Argentinians couldn't use the islands as an airbase and couldn't position fighter planes on there to prevent them from bombing again. But the right up until the Vulcan bombers dropped their first loads and were very successful in the bombing of the their targets on the islands, there were these naysayers saying, "Oh no, it will be impossible. They won't be able to do it. It's just, you know, physically impossible." And you know, we're trying to be a big nation again when we're just a tiny little nation that's got no ability to do anything. But in fact, our Air Force at the time proved them wrong. And so we bombed the airstrips. And so the Argentinians couldn't use the landing strips on the island. The Argentinians had a fairly sizable naval force. They had this enormous battleship called the Admiral Belgrano. And this sort of came round and was positioned itself very strategically near the islands in order to block the naval task force as it was coming, and it caused quite a controversy at the time that a British submarine sank the Admiral Belgrano, and the Argentinians were absolutely outraged because the Belgrano went down so quickly that virtually the entire crew perished in the sinking. And I can remember at the time that a phrase became sort of colloquial in the British language, where if anything absolutely bombed, if anything sort of went down like a stone, it was described as having gone down like the Admiral Belgrano, because the Admiral Belgrano sank so quickly. But the point is, we sank the Admiral Belgrano so that the task force was able then to approach the islands. And the upshot of it was that we landed troops at a couple of, primarily two points that were on the opposite side of the main Falkland Island, where Port Stanley is and where Fort William are, and they consisted of contingents of the Second Parachute Regiment, and also the Third Parachute Regiment, and also 40 Commando, 42 Commando, 45 Commando, also the Welsh Guards and the Scots Guards and the Gurkhas, and they were dropped at two main points. Well, in fact, one point, it was around Port San Carlo, and this was where I think there was one of the British ships was sunk by the Argentinian Air Force using Exocet missiles, but the troops managed to get ashore there and then divided into two groups. And one group, which I think consisted primarily of the Royal Marines, went over the top of the sort of hills in the centre of the island and headed straight towards Stanley and Port William. Whilst the other group, which was primarily composed of a mixture of there were some Gurkhas there, but it was primarily the Welsh Guards and the 2nd Parachute Regiment and the 3rd Parachute Regiment, and they headed for Darwin and a place called Goose Green that became very famous because of the Battle of Goose Green, where the main Argentinian force, apart from the force that was guarding Stanley, the other main Argentinian force was around Goose Green. And at Goose Green, they had dug quite sophisticated trench arrangements and had set up machine gun nests that had that were positioned in such a way that any approaching British forces would be caught in a crossfire, in effectively like a killing ground, so that they would be able to cause great damage before the and kill lots of soldiers before they even managed to get to the trenches. And the advancing parachute regiment was initially pinned down, and it was two para that were leading the advance, and two para was led by a chap called Lieutenant Colonel Herbert H. Jones. And they were pinned down by the machine gun fire from the Argentinians. And he very bravely then led the attack upon one of these machine gun posts that eventually caused the breakthrough that then enabled two para to then rout all the rest and the other following forces as well. H. Jones, unfortunately, though, lost his life in that attack. And he was posthumously awarded the VC for that. But then having captured Goose Green, the Argentinian spirit of defence was then pretty much broken, because the Argentinians, they had quite a large force at Goose Green. I think probably at least half of their soldiers on the islands were actually in Goose Green. And the attacking British forces were much smaller in number, but we managed to convince the Argentinians that we had a very much larger force. And so the Argentinians then surrendered and then discovered to their dismay that they outnumbered the British forces by like about 3-1. And so they were, you know, quite shamefaced after that.
That's brilliant. That's a very British way of doing things, isn't it? Especially with all the ones that we've heard of that we've gone through so far with our greatest Britons, particularly the ones where they would make dummies up and pretend that the force was much larger than it actually was. I can't recall the exact ones, but they had lots of fake things have been employed in the people that we've looked at, in order to deceive the enemy into thinking that the force was much greater than it was. So I would say that was a great British tradition there of convincing the enemy that we were much bigger than we actually were. And the force that went into Goose Green, would that have been like the Lost Hope or the Last Hope that we've also discussed?
Yes, I think two para would have been in that situation, because I did speak to somebody who served in the parachute regiment and who was there. And they said that they initially thought they had very little hope of being able to overrun the Argentinian positions, but they just stuck to what they stuck to their training effectively, and I think that they actually sent a message to the Argentinians that such was the anger amongst the British troops that if the Argentinians didn't surrender, then they would. They would be massacred when they were overrun, and the British troops gave the Argentinians, as I say, the impression that they were much larger in number, and so the Argentinians then felt that they were going to be overrun, and so that's why they surrendered in the way that they did. But a lot of the fighting was done at night, and this was something that was quite unusual, and I think that night vision goggles were something that sort of gave the British troops an advantage. I was told that they used a lot of tracer rounds in their guns, so that they could see where they were shooting, because otherwise they were just shooting into the darkness. And so it was a matter of superior tactics and of using intimidation and of convincing the Argentinians that they were much larger in number than they actually were. But the Argentinians, as I say, surrendered, and there were scenes of large numbers of them just sort of dropping their rifles, and the British soldiers collecting these rifles, and there being like huge mounds of discarded rifles and huge mounds of discarded soldiers' helmets, and then all these Argentinians being marched away with their hands in the air. But then the parachute regiment and I think it was the Gurkhas then set off across the island towards Stanley, where they then met up with the Royal Marines that had been going over the top. And there was the battle to retake Stanley. I don't think the battle to take Stanley was anything like as ferocious as the Goose Green battle was. And the islands then fell, and there was a tremendous celebration. And I can remember Margaret Thatcher being very celebratory and being applauded, and everybody in the news media was astounded that we'd actually been able to pull it off and to retake the islands. And so it was a great boost, really, for not specifically for nationalism, but it was a great boost for the British public at large, because, you know, we had been told by our politicians for decades after the Second World War that we were no longer a world power, that we were just this little nation, that we had to be meek and mild, and that we had to accept our absorption into the European Union, and that we had to be ashamed of ourselves, etc. And then all of a sudden we were able to do something which was a little short of miraculous, really.
Quite formidable. I mean, if we'd been thinking of ourselves as a spent force, and yet we managed to do that all the way around the other side of the world. I mean, Argentina's right next to the Falkland Islands. It's playing a home game for Argentina, isn't it? And miles away for us. And I can imagine we must have been really annoyed at the Americans. Really annoyed at the Americans. Why didn't you go in there and sort that out for us? Why did we have to send a ship all the way over the other side of the world and bother with all this refueling with the bombers when you've got America right next door, supposedly our greatest ally, the special relationship and all the rest of it? So you can see why Enoch Powell was pleased at that, because that was his view that he had for a long time, was that America was a competitor, not an ally, and that really made his view seem rational and sound to everybody else, and I should imagine the rest of the country actually had that. Well, writing in The Guardian on the 18th of October, Powell asserted that due to the Falklands War, Britain no longer looked upon itself and the world through American spectacles, and the view was more rational and it was more congenial, for after all, it was our own view. He quoted an observation that Americans thought their country was a unique society where God has put together all nationalities, races, and interests of the globe for one purpose, to show the rest of the world how to live. He denounced the manic exaltation of the American illusion and compared it to the American nightmare. He also disliked the American belief that they are authorized, possibly by the deity, to intervene, openly or covertly, in the internal affairs of other countries anywhere in the world. He wanted the UK to dissociate herself from American intervention in the Lebanon, saying, "It is not in Britain's self-interest alone that Britain should once again assert her own position. A world in which the American myth and the American nightmare go unchallenged by question or by contradiction is not a world as safe or as peaceable as human reason, prudence, and realism can make it." And I think maybe I got my dislike of Americans from here. Well, I did dislike the American television, because it was basically this Jewish comedy, New York comedy, and I really disliked it. And I found out in the last 10 years, really, that it wasn't Americans, it was American Jews on the television that I disliked. But I wonder if this didn't play into it as well. Obviously, I'm not against Americans now at all. I love my American brothers, and I work with Americans all the time. But I did used to have a very anti-American view. I know that a lot of Germans have a very anti-American view with the American bases there. And it would seem to me that maybe Powell was speaking for a lot of British people at this time, in saying that America should have helped Britain in this war, and also looking at America and the way that it behaves and the way that it intervenes around the world, and saying, well, Britain should not be involved in that. Britain should not be involved in the war in the Lebanon. We should not be involved in the Middle East, and seeing the world through our own spectacles once again, because we had to stand up for ourselves. We had to go there and defend our people. And I should imagine the actual Falkland Islanders, they must have just been so happy to see the British actually get there and rescue them from these Argentinians. We don't often hear much about the British people in the Falklands, but I suspect that they would have been extremely grateful to see the British turn up and rescue them from the Argentinians. You've got any final thoughts on what happened here and the Falklands War, Max, before we finish?
Well, we still have statements by the Argentinian government that they still have laid claim to the Falkland Islands, and these claims still don't get forthrightly slapped down. And so I think that the Argentinians still look forward to the day when they will be able to retake the islands. I think that as far as a lot of British politicians nowadays are concerned, if the islands were invaded again, then it's unlikely that a British leader might still go back down there again to retake the islands. I think out of the current crop of British leaders that we've got, well, I think people can make their own minds up about whether or not they would be for letting the Argentines take the Falkland Islands or whether they would not. But one of the things that became quite apparent was that it was only once it became apparent that we were going to win the islands back that the Americans then started to intervene again and suggest that there ought to be some kind of discussion between us and the Argentinians in order to assuage the Argentinian disquiet at what we'd done. I think that we perhaps stopped a bit short of where we were, what we could have done, because it would have been nice for us to have caused the Argentinian government that had authorized the invasion of the islands. It would have been nice if we had been able to force that government to resign and be replaced. And I think that what would have done that would have been had we landed and repaired the airfields on the Falklands and then landed Vulcan bombers on the islands, had we then proceeded to attack Argentina, had we then proceeded to pursue their navy and to sink the rest of their navy ships, had we then bombed the airfields in Argentina and demanded the resignation of the government that had I'm just trying to think of the name of the chap who was in charge. I think it was a General Galtieri was in charge of the Argentinian army. If he had been deposed and disgraced, my apologies if I got the name mixed up and it's somebody else, but that's my recollection. But the point is, we should have, in my view, punished the Argentinians and got them to make a commitment that those islands would remain British forever.
Well, they certainly deserve something like that for waging aggressive war. I would hope that they paid reparations and paid for the damage. Were they made to pay for the damage that they had caused and the costs of all of this? Do you know?
No, I don't think so. I think that was just left to us. And I think that possibly what stopped us from doing what I suggested was diplomacy and pressure from the Americans, who wanted to keep the Argentinians on side as far as they are concerned.
Well, at least we got our islands back, and the Falklanders were safe. Well, that was great. I really enjoyed that, Max. I'm sure the listeners did as well. Thank you very much for coming on today.
That's my pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.